My name is Karen Blomquist, and this particular session, which is kind of the last of 2 weeks' worth of sessions that I've been doing out here, is entitled Many Voices Deliberating in the Church. And what I'd like to do is touch on some of the themes that I've dealt with in some of the other presentations that I've given out here at Holden, and a lot of that is around the central theme that we're trying to give a lot of attention to in these early years of developing social statements in the ELCA, in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and really trying to give some focus to what it means to deliberate, hearing many different kinds of perspectives in the process of arriving at positions, rather than just immediately saying, oh, well, this is my position and this is yours, and kind of end of conversation, and the kind of polarization or the kind of fear of talking about our differences that often takes over at those points in time. Last week, at one point, I, in a very shorthanded way, suggested that there are some very Trinitarian impulses or understandings undergirding why it is that moral deliberation is important in the church. One is that of our belief in God as creator, and God who creates an incredible amount of diversity in terms of who we are, and people whose histories and experiences are quite different, and therefore the real need for there to be some kind of interdependence between the various perspectives that we might have on some issues and concerns in the world. A second article kind of reason is our understanding that we're justified by God's grace through faith in Jesus Christ. And the linkage that provides is it enables us to say, hey, you know, we are justified. We aren't justified on the basis of the positions that we take, and therefore we're free to disagree. Without being unduly threatened by that. We're somehow grounded in the gospel, and it is the gospel that unites us, that therefore enables us to say, hey, we do have this in common. Now, we have an awful lot here that we don't have in common around a given issue, but how then can we talk about that knowing that there is something in common? And then thirdly, a kind of third article reason, in terms of the work of the Holy Spirit, and if one takes seriously that Pentecost story, there's a lot of emphasis given to the Holy Spirit forming a community where there were new ways of communicating with one another. That typically is talked about in terms of the speaking in tongues phenomenon in Acts 2. But I think overall, the way in which we understand the work of the Holy Spirit and how the Holy Spirit helps us in an ongoing way to discern what it means to be faithful and what it means to be the people of God and what it means to be a community of faith. So those are just some very shorthanded kind of reasons undergirding why I think the theme of moral deliberation and trying to listen to different voices is important in the life of the church. I think it's also important from the perspective of society and the fact that we live in a society today where there often is a pervasive sense of individualism, of privatization, of subjectivism, and oftentimes people say, oh, well, it's kind of whatever anybody feels or whatever anybody thinks, and, you know, are there no constants, are there no absolutes anymore, is a familiar lament. Without a sense of the common good or trying to search for and probe to find some common values that we might have around some of the pivotal issues of the day, without that, people end up operating out of a kind of subjectivism, pursuing their own individualistic interests or concerns, and values become subjective matters of individual desire, preference, or choice, with no real rational way of resolving conflicts between them. So can there be any agreed upon ethics after Babel? There's a book by Jeffrey Stout that has that title, Ethics After Babel, and he's not writing that as a theologian but as a philosopher, but I think he has some very provocative analyses to bring to that question. And he insists that, you know, it's not that our pluralistic society is threatened by disagreements among ourselves. His own feeling is that society is threatened particularly by the acids of injustice, which eat away at the moral fiber of privileged and victimized alike. And it's also threatened by the way in which our lives become captive to, you know, what can be commodified and really captive to the values that operate in the marketplace. And then he goes on with this challenge. Whether pluralistic society survives much longer in any recognizable form depends not least on our ability and willingness to criticize it and transform it both reasonably and radically from within. And he then talks about, and I think others too are saying, it's not just a matter of saying, hey, what our society needs to be about or have its core is some kind of common value that might be talked about biblically in terms of justice, but that we also need to talk about procedural justice. In other words, how do we deal with one another, just not just hitting one another over the head with our notion of what is just, but finding ways that we can talk together and do some negotiating and therefore a kind of understanding of procedural justice that incorporates rather than discounting our diversity, and that empowers people and doesn't just kind of say, oh, well, here's the position and you've got to take it or leave it. So I think there's a very real sense in which moral deliberation is an attempt to deal with that very real phenomena in our society. Let me just go on and describe another reason or another way in which I think it can be extremely important. I think a lot of times when we talk about some issues, it's very tempting for us to not really go that much into some of the ideological assumptions that may be a part of the positions that we hold, the kind of worldview, the kind of, well, that's the way it is kind of perspective, and therefore the kinds of values that are connected with that. Now, most of the time, the reasons that we have for holding the positions that we have don't get talked about. It's, you know, like, oh, well, how do you feel about this issue or that issue? And that tends to operate very much the way in which the media operates, namely giving people just soundbite of, you know, well, what do you feel about this? Rather than that kind of being able to sit down and talk with one another and say, hey, you know, these are some of the values that I've had, or hey, this is some important experiences that I've had in my growing up years that causes me to look this way at an issue, or, you know, I've had this crisis in my life and that caused me to say, hey, you know, maybe everybody doesn't have a fair shake, or, you know, depends what the issue is. But that opportunity to look at why it is that we feel the way we do. And I don't mean by that that it necessarily has to be a lot of, you know, highfalutin analysis, but it can be some just, you know, very fragments of a kind of sharing of our own experience and in a way that helps people to make those interconnections, not only within their own experience, but how certain forces, for example, in the economy might be impacting some people in one way, and then over here, you know, for example, the guy who loses his job, and over here the person who you know, is a manager and feeling under all these pressures, and all of a sudden, you know, people begin to say, hey, you know, we thought it was, you know, kind of that we were on both on two sides of the fence, and all of a sudden there's some realization of some commonality. I think that also happens around a lot of the other social issues that we might discuss. And you know, we live in a society when whenever the issues come up, there's likely to be that kind of polarization. One of the things that I found, and I think this has been a very hard learning, is that I need those who are often most different from myself in order for me to discover what ideological assumptions I'm operating with. And, you know, and not that I necessarily want to share those, you know, that I want to look at those all of the time. But I think it's important for us to realize that any of the positions we have on an issue aren't ideology free. You know, there's certain biases that are inevitably built in, but unless we become aware of some of those factors, we can fall into a trap of saying, well, it's obvious to me, isn't it obvious to you as to why, you know, why this is the case? And again, we don't, you know, test out or get beneath the surface of what's going on. So I think talking with and trying to do this more in-depth conversation with one another can be a way in which we check some of those ideological influences, rather than assuming that, you know, such and such is Christian. It may or may not be. It may, you know, from other perspectives, when other factors are put in there, it may not be. And therefore, it's really important for us to hear one another so that some of that can get tested out. I think a large part of what I'm alluding to in these admittedly general comments, and I'm going to make some of this more concrete in just a moment, is to suggest that the process of doing social ethics, or trying to think together what it means to be faithful to God and responsive to some contemporary realities or challenges in our day, that process of doing social ethics is necessarily dialogical. It necessarily occurs between people who have different perspectives. Not always that dramatically, but at least some different experiences, some different views on the world. And we need to receive the other dialogically as other, as someone whose experiences and perspectives are different from my own, rather than assuming they are just like us. And I think that's also very similar to the kind of dynamic that occurs as we read Scripture and realize that much of what is talked about there is so different from the worldview, from, you know, from what we're dealing with, and it becomes authoritative for us in the way in which it stands over and against us. There's that kind of back and forth kind of motion going on. In such a dialogical encounter, there always remains the possibility that our own position, no matter how firmly held, might itself be transformed in the process. In fact, I would want to hypothesize that I think it is especially through such processes that moral transformation happens. You know, moral transformation more often than not happens through that encounter with the other, with that event in the world, with that person whose life story we hear and we say, oh, that's right, maybe everybody doesn't have it quite, you know, doesn't come to this issue or that or these life experiences in quite the same way that I have. As persons with diverse interests and values enter into new levels of dialogue and interaction with one another, the result may be difficult to pin down with any ideological label. In other words, we might get beyond some of the fairly rigid categories of, well, this is the conservative position, and this is the liberal position, and this is the radical position, or those kinds of labels and those kinds of boxes. And therefore, I guess my hope is, and this is not just my hope, but it's a hope that I think a number of people who've been trying to address or grapple with this dilemma in our society in recent years. My hope is that out of that kind of process, there might occur a greater enhancing of our common life, and therefore making a real contribution to the kind of democratic process that we give at least a lot of lip service to in this country. But I think people's cynicism about whether or not that works or is operative is reflected in, you know, the fact that people are often so cynical about the democratic process in our day, and whether it's in the society or, you know, some of that cynicism spills over in terms of the church too at times. So I think in that sense it has a possibility of making some important contributions to how we understand and how we work toward shaping a greater sense of the common good in the society. Let me just pause there and see if there's some questions and responses before I go on.
Huh? Interested, what sort of mechanism is there in place, if any, to discuss at the congregational level some of the issues before the church? I'm thinking back over how many years, perhaps more than I care to remember, when the issue, at least in the ALC, and I think it was pre-merger, capital punishment, mm-hmm. you know, that was sent out as kind of a position paper to congregations, mm-hmm. studied, looked at, input given, mm-hmm. went back up the chain, so to speak. Is something similar to that part yeah. of the thinking of the LCA, and how does that function, and what is the hope, and what sort of information is one do you want mm-hmm. to get out of that sort of an exercise?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of you were here yesterday when I spoke a little bit to that, and Beth Marie Halverson, who's sitting next to you, was a part of a task force working on a new death penalty statement, where actually some of that work that had been done a few years ago in a study guide mm-hmm. became a deliberative document that accompanied the first draft mm-hmm. that task force developed. What I'm going to talk about a little bit was, in the remaining minutes, is some of the processes and some of the amazing things that happened in the group that was working on an abortion statement. And that group tried initially to put out a more deliberative, open-ended kind of document, and I'm you know, which with mixed reactions, but with response from, I would say, at least a couple of hundred congregations who used it, who really found that it, quote, worked. In other words, it enabled the kind of many voices to okay. deliberate and to hear one another. And I thought giving that example might be better than kind of just giving a, you know, a kind of list of do's and don'ts. I mean, some of it is rather, if one did develop a list of how this happened, some of it is rather basic, you know, etiquette 101, you know, listening respectfully to others, etc. So just in terms of those of you who haven't been at my sessions before, I direct the department within the ELCA through which the social statements are developed. And our commitment is to, as the first thing that sees, that gets out into the church, being a kind of, we're saying a study document or a more deliberative kind of document, one that will have some direction, won't just be, you know, totally kind of open-ended, what do you think, but trying to provide some analyses of the issue, but to invite people into the conversation at that stage rather than only at a stage of having a kind of stripped down position that people then say, oh, well, I don't agree with that, or I do agree. I mean, that still will happen, because if people don't participate early on and just see something at the end, they'll say, oh, well, you know, why didn't they consider this and that and all the rest. I think it's, you know, there's no question that this can work to greater or lesser degrees, depending on the kind of congregation and the kind of congregational leadership. You know, I think in many of our congregations, what still continues to prevail is a real fear that there would be some conflict and some differences might erupt if we got into some of these controversial issues. And again, that's part of why I was saying what I said in the beginning, is I think we need to be far bolder than we've been about saying, hey, there is a glue that enables us to stick together. Glue may not be the right word, but you know, in terms of who we are in Christ, that unites us, and there's some central gospel kinds of values that not only holds us together, but can enable us to move forward and to say, hey, we can disagree ruthlessly about such and such. But then, you know, we find ourselves gathered around the altar and we realize that, you know, there's something there that holds us together. That's why I think the church can be, you know, obviously we as church are therefore different from the rest of society in terms of what we have that holds us together. But I think it's really tragic when we're afraid of these issues in the church that may in fact be raging and debated and debated rather ruthlessly in the wider society. You know, and you know, I think there's at times a kind of cautiousness, a kind of politeness of we don't want to get into those issues because they're political or they're controversial. And I think theologically, we really need to say, hey, you know, we have a freedom to be bold. I mean, and to take on some of those issues and not be afraid, because hey, you know, it's God's world. It's all the diversity within God's world. There's that passion for justice that I think is at the core of our biblical faith. We constantly need to think through what does that mean, rather than kind of shying away from it and saying, oh well, we don't want to get into that because we only want to talk about our personal relationship to Jesus. You know, you can't talk about personal relationship with Jesus without ignoring what it is that Jesus was about, which were some things that didn't exactly make people feel comfortable all the time.
Since you brought it up, do you see it as a majority or a problem in majority congregations that are not willing to look at issues that might be divisive?
Yeah, I think so. And again, it's what I've been struck with in recent months is how many lay people have gotten to us in one way or another. We've run into them at synod assemblies who've said, you know, we'd really like to talk more about this in our congregation. And, you know, I don't want to put the pastor under, you know, say the pastor's always the one who's prohibiting it. I think in some cases that is the case. And, you know, there may be some particular dynamics or particular history in that congregation that pastor, in his or her wisdom, is saying, hey, you know, we may need to stay away from that for a while. But I think, for the most part, there's a great degree of cautiousness. Even though there's occasional statistical surveys and random samples of members that are surveyed in the ELCA, and a couple of years ago, a survey was done about attitudes on social issues. And a majority, it wasn't much over a majority, but I still think this was significant, 50-some percent of the lay responses said we should not avoid issues that are likely to be controversial. You know, so, you know, that's not a big margin, but quite frankly, I felt it would probably that far more would feel the need to avoid issues than that particular piece of data tended to indicate.
In our congregation, we did a long-range planning survey, and one of the questions was the discussion of ethical issues. Would you like to see more or less emphasis? And that ended up being as one of the top five for wanting more emphasis.
Really? Interesting. Yeah.
Wasn't a part of that survey also a survey of the pastoral leadership?
Yeah. There were lay and pastors. It was higher than that of, you know, we shouldn't avoid issues because they're kind of, it was maybe, I can't remember, I think it might have been 70-something. And a lot of these, there are some clergy-lay differences in terms of how they're viewed. Well, let me just go on and talk a little bit about the abortion task force and how we tried to deal with what admittedly are some very controversial issues connected with that particular issue in our society. It certainly was not one of the issues we would have chosen to address early on, but because it was one where the ALC and the LCA did not quite have the same position, it was one that through different resolutions and then through our board's action, we were requested to bring a statement to the 91 Churchwide Assembly, which is what is going to happen. Unfortunately, I did not bring the document here. I do have it, I mean, I have it around here, but not with me right now. So I'm not so much talking about the content or about the issue of abortion, but I'm wanting to talk about the process of, or what it is that the task force experienced. One of the things I didn't get to say yesterday in terms of how social statements are developed is that when a task force is appointed to work on a social statement, attempts are made to have a, you know, as diverse a group as possible to work on that particular issue. Sometimes that's more difficult than on others in terms of knowing where people's positions are and what their expertise is and that sort of thing. But the abortion task force, for example, included health professionals, including an OBGYN specialist who herself has performed therapeutic abortions, actually since before Roe v. Wade, because she lived in a state where that was possible, and a nurse who works in a perinatal center of a major urban hospital and deals with a lot of a lot of the really problematic situations in that kind of a setting. A Hispanic woman who directs a pregnant teen educational program in a very poor Hispanic neighborhood. A black woman who is a campus pastor dealing with a lot of poor African-American women. A lawyer who deals with these issues, particularly in relationship to some of the United Way agencies. Someone who does state public policy work on behalf of the ELCA in one of our states. Two or three ethicists, theologians, parish pastors, the list could go on and on. I think there were about 14 on that particular task force. And among other things, there was some diversity in terms of where they stood on the abortion issue. We were, in appointing the task force, it was a matter of making sure that there were strong pro-choice voices, strong pro-life voices, and many people in between who, you know, refused to be boxed in one way or the other in that particular issue. And so the question is, how do you then get at what are, you know, very different values? And when people gather, it was all this kind of suspicion of, you know, who are these people and all the rest. And we did an exercise in the beginning. It's one I did last week around the abortion issue, but I think it's an example of what I was saying earlier this hour. Namely, we began by asking people in dyads to talk about the values and experience that have particularly shaped their position on the issue. Not saying, what is your position on abortion? But immediately try to set a tone of saying, okay, let's try insofar as possible to not use the pro-life, pro-choice language. You know, occasionally we would, as time went on, have to use some shorthanded reference. We'd say, well, a so-called pro-choice person might feel such and such, but for the most part we tried to back off from that. And again, it was part of this effort to search for some common values. And out of that came some very interesting things. For example, one parish pastor who was, you know, on the board of Lutherans for Life and, you know, came on the task force with some very strong anti-abortion kinds of perspectives and some very strong and, from the perspective of some of us, very negative, if not repulsive, views of women, especially women who are caught in some unintended pregnancy situations. You know, he soon began finding himself sitting next to, you know, the woman who was the abortionist. You know, in other words, the doctor who did perform abortions. And, you know, and they, and it was interesting because I would find them having these, you know, these in-depth conversations together. And that's just one example, but again and again, there was a fact that worship, and especially worship that, though it was in a somewhat traditional form, really tried to name and deal with those divisions and, you know, talk about, okay, what is it then that unites us in the midst of this? And so worship was not just, well, yeah, let's do a worship thing because we're a church-constituted task force, but really became a vital part of our life together. And I think, you know, helped enable something to happen there that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So we began by, you know, saying, okay, there's these common values and experiences, and began then to do some probing for especially common ground on the more peripheral issues. And I would say, for example, one of those issues was, okay, there's the need to talk about our society being far more supportive of life in all its phases. And the most anti-abortion voices on the task force very quickly became a part of that conversation of saying, yeah, you know, we as a society do a rather horrendous job of caring for children after they're born, and especially children who are born into poor situations, and providing support for parents and all the rest. And I think that particularly became one of these outer parameter kinds of issues where we say, yeah, now we can move with that. Now, of course, it became more and more difficult to move from those general judgments, those general shared values, to those that were more specifically focused around the issue or the ethical judgment about abortion itself. And I would say at times, you know, because we discovered, you know, the people developed some real respect for one another, that group, even after they developed some respect, found it very, very difficult to really get to the crux of the issue in terms of saying, okay, now what is, you know, where do we differ, you know, or is there something, you know, in common that we can come to? I think you know, Luther has this phrase about what it means to put on the neighbor. He talks about that in his treatise on freedom of the Christian. And, you know, really trying to stand where the other is. And I think, you know, that can become a trite phrase where we say, oh, I understand what it's like to be in your situation. And I'm not talking about it in that sense. But to really try to hear deeply and to really struggle with that other person so that you can try to understand where they're coming from. One of the things that happened in that particular group, and I think this can happen around a number of other issues too, is that at times people were trying to articulate where those people were who were at a position quite different from themselves. And at times a few comical moments when I'm thinking of two ethicists on the task force who had rather different perspectives, one strongly feminist, one not very feminist. And the woman was trying to articulate where the man was, and he said, you know, hey, you're being overly generous to me. And you know, things had reached that kind of spirit of trying to sympathetically interpret the values of the other person, and it began to be kind of amazing. I just want to say one further word about confrontation and conflict, and sometimes rather impolite behavior. I think some of the members of this task force who are fans of the idea of moral deliberation made some real new discoveries in this, because there were some pretty harsh encounters at times, some pretty angry words, and I particularly would credit the people of color who were on the task force, who were determined not to back off when the going got tough, but who were determined to hang in there and to confront and not to be nice. I think that's, you know, a group that's trying to grapple with an issue needs to get beyond that dimension of niceness in order to be able to say some pretty harsh things. And there were some pretty harsh things. So even at the end, you know, one of the men said, well, you know, I don't think so-and-so was very polite to me. But one of those women in the closing Eucharist, there was kind of a shared homily, and people were talking about what they most appreciated about being in the task force. And one of the women said, "Well, I even appreciate so and so because I can fight with him as hard as I fight with my brother." And that to me was just a very revealing kind of word. It, you know, there was somehow a forgiveness, a respect, an embracing of one another, even though at times there were some very offensive words spoken to one another. Now, I think it's fair to say, and I think a caveat that I would insert at this point is that, you know, if there were someone there, and there was no one there who was right then contemplating having an abortion, but if the issue is one where one's life, one's integrity, who one is as a person is what is being debated, and I'm thinking now particularly the issue we've been dealing with in the last week in terms of gay and lesbian issues, I think then we do have to say, hey, it can't be a, you know, nothing barred kind of conversation. I mean, I think there, you know, some of us were talking about the other night, we're talking about the distinction that there, you know, there can be that kind of passionate engagement, but there can also be a fine line that is stepped over so that it does become it does become offensive, it does become abusive of those who themselves are not just an issue, but are a person who are living out this issue. And so in talking about this kind of no holes barred kind of what can be a confrontative kind of conversation, I think depending on the issue and the people involved in it, we really do need to exercise some real care and to say in some situations, it can become abusive to someone, and we need to be very clear about respecting those boundaries and not just saying, well, okay, we're going to go at it here. But I think we need to be very sensitive to those kinds of life situations that people are in, where this is not just an issue to discuss, but it is a life and death survival kind of issue for some people. So those are, I just wanted to share some of the dynamic of that. I think the interesting thing about this is that in the midst of this, of course, the Lutheran or the media, church-related media, would be sitting there, and they'd kind of be in and out of the meeting, and sometimes it'd be a flare-up. And, of course, most media people tend to go for the controversial flare-up kind of thing. And so, you know, they'd depict some of this, and it often would be part of the story. You know, somebody might attack something that I had drafted or something, and, you know, and then later on in that meeting it was like, oh, yeah, well, I see now that's, you know, I don't feel the same way about that. But, of course, the media looks for the flashpoints. And I think part of this is a matter of saying, okay, yeah, there's going to be flashpoints. And that's, you know, that's inevitable. But, you know, how do we work it through? How do we move beyond that and begin to find some possibly common values or room to work together? But again, you know, different people have different temperaments as to whether they're able to deal with those flashpoints in just becomes a kind of back off kind of time. So let me pause, and I'd be willing to answer any further questions that you have about that particular process, which I'm just giving as an example of a process that I was a part of that I think is a time when moral deliberation did happen in a group of people who were quite different and who had quite different positions on an issue. I'd be willing to entertain questions on that, but I think what would be more helpful is for us to talk together about our own experiences of moral deliberation, the possibilities and some of the pitfalls, how you perhaps have experienced or caught some glimpses of this, both in a positive or not so positive way here at Holden, how you've experienced that or what you see as some real problems of trying to do that back there, and particularly in a local congregation. So let's talk about some of the kinds of feelings and problems and possibilities that you see.
One thing that you said is something that I suspected. I felt that the task force on abortion was different from the task force on capital punishment. Because I know that after the first meeting, I went to Jerry and I said, how was this committee selected? And I think there was much more care given to the task force on abortion and attention to the differences and the diversity than there was given to the one on death penalty. And that was a very frustrating experience for me. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate your concern for wanting to, you know, seek that. And, I had to kind of laugh when I read one of the articles that came out. I can't remember what the name of the magazine is from, but it identified me as a pastor whose husband is a police officer. And what happens to be that my husband is very pro-capital punishment. And but I felt, why was I identified by my husband? I did have a frustrating experience that way, I think. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I loved it. I loved being, you know, in that process of talking and learning and discovering that common ground and recognizing you can talk. And recognizing, you know, so much of what you said, just going, yeah, Karen. You know, finding that being united in worship. That was a very powerful experience. Finding that we're united in matters of salvation, and this is more our response to what we've been given, was a really neat experience for me. Mm-hmm. My one concern still comes in is I understand kind of the deliberation we experience as individuals, whether it be in a small community like this, or whether it be back in our congregations, or whether it be on a task force, but how do we handle the deliberation on the broader scale? Let's say at a synod assembly. How do we handle it before actually forming or making the full statement to a church-wide assembly? How can we be involved more on moral deliberation on a broader scale? Mm-hmm. And I know I was talking to one of the pastors yesterday, and he was even suggesting, how do we handle it at synod assemblies? Mm-hmm. Is it more just, here is the statement, now we want people just to react to it? Or here's the spectrum within the issue. Here are, you know, the questions, here is some of the research, here are the different perspectives, and making kind of a presentation, and then letting people talk. There's a difference. It's a difference in tone. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's an issue. It's an issue of, like, what you send out to the pastors, mm-hmm. in terms of how much time you give us, mm-hmm. How it's presented. Mm-hmm. Is it something we just react to, or is it something where we're invited to talk about? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I still don't know where you go after that. That's what I keep on struggling with this. When is it that you reach the point where you do go ahead and make a prophetic statement? No, do you have to, and also, I'm getting into another area of my concern.
You have a number of questions there. Let me just speak to the first one, namely the how does this happen on a wider scale rather than,
yeah,
you know, a small group. I think I've been interested to find that in a number of synods there are certain procedures that they have begun to draw up,
mm-hmm,
to keep, you know, some big issue from just being kind of brought up the last minute in terms of a resolution. You know, one has a timeline of up to 6 months even, and the idea being that,
wow,
congregations, any of these resolutions on social issues, at least 3 or 4 months before the assembly will be sent out to every congregation, giving every congregation a chance to really talk about it. I think it is a matter of it happening much more in a local congregation, so that hopefully that would affect the quality of the discussion that might happen on a convention floor. Now, again, that's a nice, naive kind of hope.
Yeah.
Certainly one of the things that will encourage this to be more the case at the churchwide assembly consideration of these documents is a provision that it is possible for there to be an addendum attached to a social statement that summarizes a dissenting perspective from that which,
mm-hmm,
which is, you know, that let's assume now that a statement is adopted, and there is, it would have to be at least, you know, 20%, not just a couple of voices, but there is a substantial dissenting,
yes,
voice in that, and the way in which that is identified is through the quality of the debate on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, those points and those perspectives being articulated and argued and on the floor of the assembly, that will,
yeah,
that's what is the summary of that kind of debate that would be a part of the dissenting kind of view. I know there is also the hope, some of the rules that are going to be proposed for the churchwide assembly this summer to adopt is the possibility that the chair, when it's around an issue where there's real controversy, could invite those who feel differently on an issue to meet in two separate rooms to do some strategizing and planning about how the various arguments could best be presented on the floor of the assembly, rather than the kind of random thing of, you know, well, Joe Blow here, it feels real strongly, and they're going to get up and rant and rave about something, and other people might agree with Joe Blow, say, oh my goodness, why did he have to say that? So an attempt to have more reasoned debate,
yes,
and to say, okay, now that, you know, that group that feels that this statement needs to be more pro-choice or whatever, being able to sit down and say, okay, now what are the points that need to be raised and who can speak most effectively to that?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, more of a, you know, I'm not saying that's going to happen, because that will be at the discretion of Bishop Chilstrom or whoever is chairing at that point.
That would be neat. I think that would be really neat, because I've seen so many times it's in assemblies where you get kind of an emotional outburst and can work either way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where you get a few people who feel that they have to be heard,
mm-hmm,
and tend to dominate things.
You had more in your question, Beth.
I've got one follow-up.
Okay.
Right there. How would the dissenting addendum be utilized, or what happens to that later on, or what's...
The idea is that when a social statement would be printed, you know, there'd be the body of the social statement, then there would be like a footnote or end note. So there would be an addendum saying, hey, you know, there were various perspectives that felt this way. And I think the advantage of that is it tries to give some voice rather than just a kind of silent historical record of where others were at. In other words, in fact, I think it's interesting is that it was a church historian who's done some significant work at looking at the history of the development of social statements in one of the predecessor bodies. She's the one who offered that resolution to the procedural document. And it, so it was her work as a historian saying, hey, you know, one needs to know what else was going on rather than just what the official vote was. Mm-hmm. And so it's an attempt to preserve some of that flavor.
Is there a process to review documents 5 years, 10 years, 2 years, whatever, so it doesn't just get placed in concrete and then, okay, we've looked at this, we don't have to discuss it any longer?
Yeah, there are very specific procedures now for revising a social statement. So, for example, if one of these is summer past and 2 years later, there could be, I mean, it couldn't just be revised on the spot, it would have to be calling for a revision in it. You know, so it would probably be a total of a 4-year kind of process. Quite frankly, I hope we don't have to go through that.
There's a system for that.
Yeah, there's a system for that. Yeah, because I think any of these are, you know, attempts to say what, to say something about what it means to be faithful and responsive to this situation in this point in time, which is likely to change. One of the reasons, in addition to the fact that there were some different nuances in the abortion statements, one of the reasons our board also felt it was important is the fact that one of the predecessor statements on that topic was from 1970. Before Roe v. Wade, the other body had a series of statements, the last of which was in 1980. And there's been a lot happening around that issue since then. And so what operated in a pre-Roe v. Wade sense is not necessarily the same way today. So I think on a lot of these issues, certainly the area of international peace and international peace kinds of issues. I look at the peace statements that we've inherited from the predecessor church bodies, and even though they're basically good, it nevertheless is primarily phased or framed in terms of a U.S. versus USSR Cold War kind of framework, and dealing with all the regional skirmishes and all the rest. You know, that was not the predominant concern a few years ago, and so any of that becomes very, you know, it's like 1989, there were some real shifts in terms of how one frames and talks about international issues.
So you're never done with the process.
Yeah, ongoing.
Yeah.
But I was going to ask the question, are there any done? I mean, are there any statements that are out in prison from the new church?
No, because the process typically is at least a 2 to 3 year process, and the first the ELCA has now been around for almost 3.5 years, but the first assembly we had to kind of get the ground rules or the procedures in place and get those approved first. Our hope is that by September we would have three, a foundational social statement on the church and society, a Lutheran perspective, which provides some general perspectives of how we see the church and the world. And then abortion and death penalty, those being two that we were requested to do. The other ones that are on the docket are for 93, human sexuality, the environment, and one on race, ethnicity, and culture. And then we're hoping by 95 to have ones on economic justice and on international peace, global security kinds of issues. Typically, two is the most that a churchwide assembly could probably deal with, but we're loading it up early on. Of course, we might get asked to do some others, too. And again, because it takes time to develop these through deliberative processes that involve some input that aren't just, you know, quickly passed.
I think that could be frustrating for you to be asked to do something. But really, you need time. You need lots of time to do it in order to gain involvement.
Yeah.
You know, from the people, so they just to have them gain ownership of the process, and that takes time.
Yeah. One of the things that we had to do, both in terms of the appointment of the task force dealing with abortion and death penalty, and this will address the one concern you were raising a little bit, is the timeline we had was much shorter than would typically be the case.
Yeah.
And therefore, it was very clear that people on those task forces needed to be people who were well familiar with the issues already. And quite frankly, it was very difficult to get as many people who were supportive of the death penalty. At least, it was hard to surface those names. I mean, obviously, there's lots of those names, but it, you know, in terms of people who, you know, were kind of ready to hit the ground running in terms of serving on a task force like that. And through the process now, we've identified a lot more names, but we just didn't have access to those names, and it's part of the difficulty, which is why one of the words I like to get out, I was talking to Carol Tomer about this yesterday, is that we're very interested in receiving, I mentioned the topics that we're working on, the economic justice and international peace ones. Those task forces have not yet been appointed. And if you know of people with particular background, interest, expertise, and we define expertise not just whether they have letters after their name, but some of the practical expertise that is important too. If you know of people, let us know, because it's very difficult for us to know, be as aware of some of the wealth of expertise that we have in our church. And so we're really hampered unless we get names from people in the life of the church. Well, thank you for this conversation.